Kaffee in seiner besten Form. Mit Cubo wird jeder Kaffee auf Knopfdruck zum Genussmoment. Denn mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo genießt du feinsten Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Vollmundige Aromen dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie und über 17 Sorten Kaffee für jeden Geschmack. Erlebe Premium-Kaffee schon ab 29 Euro. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo Kapselmaschinen in deiner Chibo-Filiale und auf chibo.de.
Stu does America.
Subscribe on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Hit the bell for notifications. Comment below the show. Comment above the show. Post on social media about your comments, about the show, whatever you want to do. Also go to Stu Does America, get your Stu Does America merch as well at StuDoesMerch.com. The code is Stu10, get 10% off your entire order. Dominic Pino is going to join us to break down the math behind Trump's tariff decisions. We've got some major developments in the Signal leak story we want to talk about. We'll look at what the mainstream media is ignoring and what you should do on your phone. Because with that story, this is something specific to you on your phone. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. But we're going to start by doing the left's big anti-Trump push. Yes, they're not going to sit back. They're going to just let this go and give Donald Trump a nice clear path until he runs for his third or fourth or fifth terms. No. They're going to make sure they do everything they can to stop it. And there's always a protest movement around. And I always felt like it was a big missed opportunity for the left, thankfully, back in 2017, when they came out and protested Donald Trump on the first day of his presidency, on January 20th. There was a massive protest. And it felt really inauthentic, right? He hadn't even done anything yet. what are you protesting? What if he does a great job? We all know they were going to protest eventually, but you have to make it seem at least believable. Make it so it could seem organic, and they didn't do that last time. They're trying to wait a little bit this time, and now they're launching into their protest cycle. Hands off! Yes, the protest is called Hands Off. Hands off protesters across U.S. rally against President Donald Trump and Elon Musk, the electric vehicle entrepreneur and solar CEO. Here's the big, I was like, hands off, what does that even mean? Hands off, it means hands off my Medicaid and my Medicare and my Social Security. By the way, Donald Trump has absolutely no intention of touching any of those programs. To my chagrin, like, I wish he would touch them. He won't, he doesn't want to do that at all. Hands off our jobs, hands off our wallets, hand off our books, is that what that says? I don't think Donald Trump's touching your books. Hands off fair elections, hands off personal data, public lands, veteran services, cancer research, blah, 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 blah. Basically, the litany of left-wing complaints that you'd expect they want Donald Trump to keep his hands off of. Really, really effective messaging. It reminds me of kind of moveon.org, which, you know, we've talked about this somewhat recently, but like they started this to, wait, so what? President Bill Clinton hooked up with Monica Lewinsky. Move on. It's no big deal. And then they had to still name that. They kept the name through the Me Too movement, which was bizarre as they were trying to argue, no, Me Too is really important, but move on from when the president was hooking up with his interns. I can move on from that, but now Republicans might be doing it, so it's important. Here's what this protest looked like. Huge protests across the country. This is Huntington Beach. Look at that. Get that guy in a little tricycle thing. And I don't know, got a few people there. Then this is what, is this Duluth? Or is this still Huntington? I can't tell. They look pretty cold, so I'll say it's Duluth. Duluth. We have San Diego, another protest there. Much nicer in San Diego. But again, what are you talking about? Like 100 people maybe? You know, not nothing, but not too many people. Los Angeles had a protest as well. Here you got maybe a couple hundred people. You know, of course, it's our nation's second largest market, so you'd expect it to be a little bit more. People cheering on Eat the Rich, which is fantastic messaging, always good and new. Then you got hands off our Constitution, because they care so much about the Constitution in D.C. Three people there. Two with signs. The lady in the middle, she's like, I'm not holding the sign. No, whatever we do. And then two more people sitting with signs in D.C. You could see there's a crowd kind of walking in the background. These are not massive protests. Really, I don't think a huge impact was had by these particular protests, but this is what the left does. This is, you know, many of them are unwilling to go to productive parts of our economy and work. So they do this instead. Amanda Carpenter is, you know, upset at, she's not a big fan of Trump, and she tweets this. It's very obvious. Whatever's happening in the streets right now is much more massive than the Tea Party. Huh? Comparatively, I remember what the protests looked like in April 2009. It was scattered. This is far more organized, and if it stays under the hands-off umbrella and doesn't disintegrate, it stands to be very popular, powerful, excuse me. Now, I would say is my particular opinion on that. I mean, I think there are things that will make massive movements occur that Trump could do. The economy, and we're going to get into that in a little bit, is, you know, a big part of that. But, you know, first of all, just to point out briefly, like, I don't think it was scattered at all back then. In fact, we have some pictures of this. This is, by the way, someone said, hey, scattered, what about this photo? And this is from a later Tea Party. I don't know if it was the one they called ours, a Tea Party rally, which, of course, happened in Washington, D.C. I don't know which one this was. There's a tax day one as well. And Amanda responded that it's not what happened in April. The big Tea Party protest in D.C. happened in September of that year. But there were a lot of protests in April, and we were there at a lot of them. Here's the one in April 2009. This one was in San Antonio. A really good crowd, much larger than the crowds that seemed to be at most of these events around the country. A couple of other photos from that, from Ground View. Oh, who was speaking there? Oh, yes, our one, our only Glenn Beck speaking there with the Don't Tread on Me flag in the background. But it wasn't just San Antonio in April 2009. They were also in Sacramento, very good-sized gathering in Sacramento. Atlanta, I remember as well, a solid gathering in Atlanta, April 15th, 2009. Columbia, April 2009 as well. Decent crowd there. Lansing, Michigan, a lot of people out in Lansing for that particular event. One of the things that's interesting about this, and it's tough to really tell. Look, we don't know where this protest movement's going to go. Why not? Could wind up being massive and make a real difference. That does happen from time to time. It is not all that common. Most of these things kind of come and go and flame out relatively quickly, but it could happen. Amanda Carpenter's observation that these are much more organized, I think, takes points away from it, these current ones. A real protest movement does come typically from the grassroots. You can juice it a little bit. You can goose it a little bit. But generally speaking, it's got to be somewhat natural. And the 2009 protest that started kind of as sort of a tax protest turned into a larger Tea Party thing. Of course, Glenn's series of events as well was part of that. And, you know, that they started and they grew and they were big, but they weren't organized. They weren't like, there were no real professionals tied to it. You know, Glenn did the 9/12 project. We specifically kept a lot of those bigger organizations out of it. We didn't want the Republican Party fundraising off of it. We didn't want that. We wanted it to be somewhat separate. And, you know, when you see the groups that are tied to these protests, you can tell. Like, the organization is, hey, we need something to protest Trump. Let's put a bunch of money behind it. Let's get these people aligned for this one thing, and we'll get them all out there. Just because a lot of people show up, and I don't know that they did in a lot of these events, but just because a lot of people show up does not mean that you have a movement. You need people who actually care, who aren't just out there generically protesting every single time a Republican gets into office. It has to be something different. It has to feel different. And I don't think they have that going on as well. Now, of course, these kind of flamed out. They weren't particularly impressive. What do you do with that information? I guess you just try again. April 19th now is the next time. So if you're looking for something to do on April 19th, a nationwide anti-Trump protest is going to be thrown out there with the same hands-off messaging, which I think they think is good. It's hard to know for sure because it seems so counterintuitive that hands-off would be a good rallying cry. Usually what happens is people at the top of these organizations come up with what they think is a really super special slogan or whatever to inspire all the little people to do their thing. And then at the end of the day, if it is organic and people do care, they come up with their own stuff. And that's what makes them rally. We will see if that happens on the left. Now, of course, it's not just protesting on the left. There's a lot more to their movement than just protesting, just aimlessly walking through the streets with signs printed up for them by unions. There's more to it than that. For example, they like vandalizing things. Pregnant Tesla passenger injured by flying rock on Vancouver Street. By the way, this one is more than vandalism against a Tesla. Could have easily killed this woman. This is, you know, you start throwing rocks at moving cars. We've seen, I mean, I remember this has happened many times, but people, you know, dropping rocks off of overpasses at cars, killing people. I mean, this could be horrible. So thank God it's not going to be that serious in that particular case. We also have a clean energy executive, an ex-federal worker charged with defacing Tesla vehicles, a former government employee and his wife, an executive at a clean energy nonprofit, have been charged with defacing several Tesla vehicles in and around the Capitol Hill neighborhood in Northeast Washington. Justin Fisher surrendered to authorities and he was charged with 8 counts of defacing private property. Well, it's so fascinating that this is happening because, like, there's been this kind of changeover, right, where it was a left-wing priority to buy a Tesla forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Then, you know, Elon Musk started getting a little bit less popular. But even through that beginning series, like when he, you know, opened up the Tesla plant early during COVID and he, you know, flirted with maybe supporting Ron DeSantis, and that didn't really hurt Tesla. And in fact, it didn't really get applied right away to Elon Musk. It was, you know, he was still hosting Saturday Night Live, right, at this point. And at some point, especially when he actually endorsed Donald Trump, then it became uncool for the left to have Teslas. It all of a sudden was a bad thing. They started selling them, they started protesting them, they started lighting them on fire. But what's fascinating about that entire process is the overwhelming majority of people who own these cars are liberals. Like, you know, it's kind of like what we talk about with the economy. Like, if you put a tariff on a country's cars, like, they can't move their entire factory here in a week. Right? Like, that's a multi-year process for a lot of these companies. And it's the same thing here. Like, you don't just buy a new car when the owner of the car company goes out of favor a week later. Like, you got to hold on to that car in most cases until the end of the lease, maybe until at least you get the car paid down enough that you're not upside down on it. So these people on the left are protesting Donald Trump by trashing left-wingers' cars. I mean, it couldn't be more perfect. What could possibly be more awesome than that? I don't know. Now, I will say there's more than just this going on. And we are in a situation now where the economy is having its troubles. The Dow, at least most of the day, has been down. It's varied between a couple hundred points and over 1,000. This is after 2,200 points one day, another 1,500 points another day. We're down about over 10%. In the market here in about 3 or 4 days. That's really rough. It's rough sledding for you out there. And if you have a 401k, you know, I empathize with it. I've got one. Everyone seems to have a 401k if you're able to, you know, if you're of a certain age and you've put some money away for retirement. And it sucks to check it right now. Like, you look at it and you're like, wow, this really blows. Like, my, you know, I wanted to increase the 401k, and Donald Trump was so good for business the first term. This has been really, really scary here the second term. And one of the things that's frustrating about this is Donald Trump is doing a lot of really good things in so many areas of his presidency that, you know, the tariff thing is really sort of derailing that right now. And it's making it so that's the focus. And it sucks in a lot of ways. Right now we're seeing investors kind of freaking out. And that comes, that goes. We'll see where this thing lands. I'm not in an all-out panic about it. A lot of people are. The fear and greed index is something that a lot of sites have. This CNN has a version of it. And then it's just a bunch of, you know, economic measures that are put into, like, are people scared right now or are they investing? And this is where it stands at the moment. It's at 5 out of 100. So you see they're in the extreme fear category right now. Not a huge shocker. I actually saw it as low as 2 today when it comes to extreme fear and extreme greed. Now, of course, extreme greed is basically to kind of tell you, hey, people are too greedy. The market's too hot, right? Right now, they're saying it's the opposite. We're going the opposite direction, the wrong direction. And so the entire Trump presidency is in a bit of danger right now. If this doesn't get cleared up, we don't know what that looks like yet. Either Donald Trump's policies start working perfectly and, you know, everyone starts importing jobs and the markets go up and everyone's really happy. Possibility, obviously, what Donald Trump believes is going to happen. Or maybe some of these tariffs start going away. There was rumor of a pause today, a 90-day pause, which was hilarious because the market went up about, you know, 1,500 points when that happened. And it was a report of a rumor of a consideration of a temporary pause in the tariffs. Just that made the markets go up 1,500 points. Turned out not to be true. Trump came out and said that's fake news. But you know, the whole presidency. I mean, he is betting his presidency on this, right? When you talk about the economy, it's so central to everything that you're doing. It really has a lot to do with your approval ratings, what happens in the midterms. If the country's still struggling like it is right now, when those elections come around, I mean, we could see a huge wave election against Republicans. That's not going to make Trump's agenda any easier to pass. So there's a lot of risk going on here. I think he knows this risk. I think he believes it's still the right thing to do. So he's going ahead with it. And you might think to yourself, well, this is going to give a huge advantage to the Democrats if this continues. And that is possible. I mean, I think it is something really legitimate to worry about, though it's premature to worry about what's going to happen in the election. There's so much stuff that's going to happen between now and then. We probably won't even remember any of this this time even existed. Who knows? But what's fascinating about this is the left will always find a way. They will always find a way to make things competitive, even if things aren't going well for Republicans. Why? Because they will always swarm towards the dumbest possible option. There is a big monologue that's out today from John Oliver's show this weekend, made the rounds widely on social media. And I made this argument to you before, so you've probably already heard it. But for those who haven't, John Oliver is an incredible blessing to conservatives in general. And the reason for that is this particular monologue was about, hey, actually, women are totally equal with men in sports, and there's no difference at all, and it's totally overblown, and men and women are basically the exact same in sports. Now, every single piece of knowledge you've been able to acquire from the beginning of your life till now tells you the exact opposite. If you look at the world records for men and women in every single sport, men's are faster, they are more athletically impressive, they are... I mean, look, you go, the younger you get to 5 and 6 year olds, not much of a difference, right? As you get older and older and, you know, you go through puberty and you have all the testosterone, you wind up being quite easily athletically superior or the equal man and an equal woman, right? Like, that's just the way it is. And you know what? That no person on earth needs more explanation than that. Well, John Oliver goes through and gives you 25 minutes about how actually he's smart and actually there's no difference at all between the sexes. And anyone who thinks that there's a difference between men playing women's sports, you know, they're just lying to you. And here's my really funny, condescending argument about it. And that is an incredible benefit to conservatives because, you know, John Oliver is almost uniquely capable of taking an argument and taking the worst, the absolute worst instincts of the farthest left nut job and making it look like the only obvious and sane choice. And so all these people, these rich liberals who are funding these organizations, take that internally and then wind up going and promoting the worst possible directions. So it doesn't even matter if the Republican has a good presidency or not. They're automatically competitive because the left is so insane. And so that's kind of where we are now. And of course, this is where the left always goes. They always go the craziest route possible, which is wonderful for conservatives to be competitive. There's a new poll out in New York. AOC leads Chuck Schumer in a head-to-head New York primary matchup by double digits. The survey from the liberal firm Data for Progress, shared with Politico, found that 55% of Democratic likely voters said they lean towards Ocasio-Cortez, while 36% backed or leaned toward Senator Schumer. 9% were undecided. They'll always find a way to kind of keep the two-party system does seem to do this. Like, it, you know, as much as I don't really like the two-party system, it does find a way to take these two parties and make it so it's going to be competitive almost every single time. It just really is, because there's always incentives for both sides to kind of go their own way. And the left continues to pick this hardcore left-wing position that is so obviously insane to 90% of Americans, even a lot of Democrats, that even they are looking around and saying, gosh, I don't really want to go that direction. This is how Joe Biden gets a nomination in the first place. But it does seem like the left is in power now. The energy of the party is on the left, and that's going to make things a lot easier. I do worry about the economy, though. I do think it's legitimate. A lot of people will tell you, oh, come on, this is actually Donald Trump's crashing the economy on purpose. This is a big plan that he wants it to be bad. He wants your 401k to go down. I don't think Donald Trump wants your 401k to go down. Don't believe people who say that to you. You know, Donald Trump, I think, wants the best for Americans, and that means not having their retirement wiped out. That being said, what he's doing might not wind up being the best economic policy for us going forward. I want to talk to Dominic Pino about that. We'll do it next. So spring is here. The birds are chirping. Yes, the sun is out. And your yard, it still looks like a crime scene from a landscaping documentary. You could wander through a big box store while a teenager named Skylar gives you bad plant advice, or go with the other option, fastgrowingtrees.com. Actually, get it right. How about that? These folks are serious. Thousands of plant varieties curated by real experts who know exactly what thrives in your climate. That is super important. I can't tell you how many trees I've had die because they're like, oh, well, Texas, it should work in Texas. Yeah, but what happens in the freezes that we have in Texas? Oh, well, sorry, too late to replace it. That's not fast growing trees. They know the climate really well. They know, whether you want, shade or privacy or just want to flex on your neighbors, whatever it is, they got you covered. No lines, no hauling muddy trees in your backseat. Just click, order, and boom. Plants delivered to you, your door in like just a few days. Plus 24-hour, they have care and growing advice to keep everything alive, which is a really nice resource if you're like me and don't know anything about this stuff. Right now, they've got massive spring deals, up to half off select plants. When you use the code STEW at checkout, you're going to get 15% off. The code is STEW at checkout, 15% off. It's fastgrowingtrees.com. The code is STEW. Go make your yard look like you planned it that way. Yeah, it's fastgrowingtrees.com. The code is STEW.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.
I'm joined once again by Dominic Pino. He's the Thomas L. Rhodes Journalism Fellow at the National Review Institute and host of the Econception podcast, which you can subscribe to wherever you get your podcast. Dominic, thanks for coming back on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Stu. Always a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a great time to be alive. Nothing going on in the world of the economy right now. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm trying to be an optimist on this, but like, at the very least, at least we're actually talking about a policy for once. I mean, it's not like, what was the latest burn from AOC or Trump on Twitter? We're actually talking about economic policy. So maybe that's a good thing.
I guess that's true. It would just be nice if it was informed by some facts or reasoning by either side. But no, we're looking at a major policy being implemented solely by the president. Acting alone, he is not doing this in consultation with Congress. He is not doing this as a response to like a huge demand from voters. If you look at the polling on these tariffs, and if you ask specific questions about specific countries, especially places like Canada, they turn out to be very unpopular. But the president is going through with it anyway because he believes, contrary to all evidence, that trade deficits are bad in and of themselves and that United States tariff policy can change them.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people I talk to say, because I'm a free trade guy and I believe that way for a long time. And they say, well, you know what you're getting with Donald Trump, right? He ran on these policies and now he's implementing them. But like, I think it's fair for an average citizen who might have even supported Donald Trump in the election to say, hey, what I liked about Donald Trump was the 2019 economy. And sure, he hit some tariffs. He did some tariffs on washing machines and, he flirted with stuff on steel. And there were some of that. But that was not the overarching part of what he did in his first term. This does seem to be a real U-turn.
Yeah, depending on how you look at it, the goods that these tariffs cover are worth about 9 or 10 times more than the goods that tariffs were applied to during his first term. So it's an entirely different policy, even though the first term tariffs didn't really work out that well either, but they were smaller in scope and so had less ability to do damage. These are tariffs against every country, basically every country in the world, including the countries that we already have free trade deals with. We have 12 bilateral trade agreements, and then we have two multilateral ones, the USMCA that Trump himself negotiated, and then the Central American Free Trade Agreement as well, which involves some of the smaller countries in Central America. And this measure will apply tariffs to all of those. So the idea that this is a negotiating tool in order to get more free trade deals, well, if that's the case, then why are we tariffing the countries that we already have free trade deals with?
Yeah, it's hard to understand. And I mean, he likes tariffs. He likes to put pressure on these other economies to get things that he wants. And I think that's been kind of the part of the problem with the messaging of all this is I had a real tough time trying to figure out what the goal of the policy was, because I hear both that it's a negotiating tool to get everyone to zero tariffs, because that's what he actually wants. And then I also hear that he's doing this to try to return jobs to the United States. For that to happen, you'd want tariffs, I guess, to remain high. Well, your article actually helped me make the decision, I think, on this. You wrote one called How Trump's Tariff Table Was Made. And because of the way he calculated these things, I don't think it's a negotiation tool to get to zero, because even if they go to zero, we won't go to zero. So do you have a sense as to what the point of all of this is?
Yeah, I think you're right, Stu. I don't think the goal is zero. And I think it's pretty clear from what the president has been saying since the 1980s that he just likes tariffs for their own sake. He thinks they're a good idea. It is true that it's very confusing if you listen to voices within the administration. There's been lots of conflicting ideas going back and forth about whether there are negotiations, whether that's not the point. But if you read the president's executive order, it's pretty clear that it views the problem to be solved as the existence of trade deficits. It is not based on other countries having high tariffs, and it's not even true that other countries have high tariffs. Most rich countries anyway in the world have very low tariffs. The United States actually has slightly higher tariffs than a lot of countries, but it's like the difference between 2.5% and 1.5%, right? So the idea that the U.S. was getting ripped off on this is just not true. And the formula, like you said, is based on the existence of a trade deficit. It's not based on other countries' practices. It's not based on anything like that. It just assumes that if a trade deficit exists, it must be because the other country is doing something unfair. And that just isn't true. And so as long as that executive order stays in effect, that is what's going to happen. It's not going to be connected to tariffs. It's not going to be connected to free trade at all. It's just connected to trade deficits.
Mm. Can we walk through the trade deficit a little bit? Because I think people hear that number and they do feel like it connects with people. It connects. Say, hey, you know, we got a trade deficit with this country. They're screwing us over. This is bad for our country in some way. They're taking money. That's the way that Trump often phrases it. Is that the right way to look at it?
No, it's not. The first thing that's the mistake with the way that the administration has done this is that it only includes the trade deficit in goods. It doesn't include services at all. The United States has a big trade deficit in goods, but we actually have a surplus of about $300 billion a year in trade and services. None of that gets included. For some reason, protectionists don't care about services at all. They only care about goods. It's a very strange ideology they have. But one of the all a trade deficit says is that one country buys more stuff from the other country than the other country buys from it. That's all it says. And we can think of lots of perfectly legitimate reasons why that might be the case. Take Botswana, for example. Botswana is a relatively poor country by global standards. It's a country in Africa, but it's also a country that has a lot of diamonds. And so a rich country like the United States buys a lot of diamonds from Botswana. The relatively poor people in Botswana don't buy a lot of stuff from the United States. So the United States has a trade deficit with Botswana. Is that a problem? Well, the Americans are getting the diamonds that they want. People in Botswana, like I said, they're just not able to buy that much. And so who's made worse off by this state of affairs? No one, really. And what a trade deficit means in practice as well is it always comes with a capital account surplus. And so what that means is that all those dollars that go to other countries to buy their stuff, those dollars have to be used to buy stuff in dollars, which means to buy American stuff. And so those dollars end up coming back to the United States in the form of foreign direct investment. That means buying our government bonds, but it also means investing in our companies. It means buying stock in our companies. It means creating jobs for Americans by building factories here. And that is what happens all the time. The United States is the number one destination in the world for foreign direct investment that only exists because we have a trade deficit.
Yeah, and by the way, you look at those two charts, they mirror each other almost exactly. You can tell exactly what's going on there. Dominic, let me go to the argument of tariffs overall when it comes to, you know, this sort of more protectionist approach to trade. this, you know, in my mind has always been the purview of the left. Like, I feel like I've heard this argument forever from the Richard Trumkos of the world, union bosses, you know, Democrats, you know, especially in like the 80s, who really pushed for this approach. Am I crazy or is this a new thing on the right?
Well, it's always been a little bit bipartisan. You always had some voices on the right who were calling for this. But in the 1980s, for sure, it was a much more Democratic issue. You had guys like Dick Gephardt in Congress who were big on this, ran for president on this. You had, like you mentioned, the union leaders who are all just in the pocket of the Democratic Party, and they still are. You had the UAW coming out and saying it supported these tariffs, even though it thinks Donald Trump is evil, because it's just reflex for them. The unions always support tariffs no matter what they do, even if they harm their own employees. And we've seen that with the United Auto Workers. Auto workers are going to be some of the most harmed by these tariffs because auto supply chains are extremely international. And we've already seen some layoffs at some car companies. But it's more important for the UAW to play politics and be on the right political side of this issue, which for them always means supporting protectionism. And so you look back at the 80s, you had these examples of guys like Jack Kemp and the Republican Party arguing against protectionism and trying to pare it back. You had Ronald Reagan, who gets sort of described as a protectionist sometimes, even though he really was fighting a rear guard action for more free trade against a protectionist Congress that was, for most of his presidency, controlled by Democrats. And so he caved into them every once in a while on some things. And that was a bad part of his legacy. But a positive part of his legacy was that he negotiated the first United States-Canada free trade deal, which was then extended to include Mexico in the 1990s, and has made both countries better off.
Let's end here, Dominic, because one of the things I talked to when I talked to friends of mine, and I'll go through these points where I think tariffs are a bad idea and the reasons why. And one of the things they kind of come back to is, well, whatever, but what we're doing isn't working, right? Like, there's this concept among the right, which I feel is relatively new, that what we're doing as far as trade goes just isn't working at all. Can you kind of give the plus side of free trade? What has free trade brought America?
The good thing about free trade is it doesn't require you to live in a fantasy land in order to understand how it works. Protectionism is the idea that's based on people acting contrary to their self-interest, the government acting in the national interest, and special interests staying on the sidelines. None of these three things really describe how people actually work. And so since Adam Smith was talking about it in Wealth of Nations, we've understood that free trade allows you to better align those incentives so that you can act in your self-interest, and that will also be to the benefit of others. You do this all the time when you're in the United States, because the founding fathers in the Constitution basically made the United States into what was at the time in the late 1700s, the world's largest free trade zone, because they prohibited states from tariffing each other. Now, there's lots of good reasons, if the protectionists are right, to put tariffs between states, because we see huge economic disparities between states. For example, Massachusetts has a GDP per capita that's roughly double that of Mississippi. And the average wage in Massachusetts is $14 an hour higher than in Mississippi. Would Massachusetts be better off if it put tariffs on Mississippi? I don't think it would, and I don't think most protectionists would say that it would. But if that's true in that context, why is it not true between the United States and Canada? United States and Canada are just as close together. They're actually closer together, closer to Massachusetts than Massachusetts is to Mississippi. Lots of states are basically the size of many different countries around the world, so it can't be like a size question. It's just this idea that somehow when you go between countries instead of within countries, the entire idea changes. You wouldn't want the government putting tariffs on you for buying things from the city next door to yours, or from the county next door to yours, or from the state next door to yours. So why for the country next door to yours? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think we often lose sight of it. It's not really countries buying from countries, right? It's individuals and businesses buying from other producers in those other countries. It's individuals in America making choices on the things that they want, right? And that is, somehow lost in all this. Dominic Pino, Thomas L. Rhodes Journalism Fellow, the National Review Institute, host of the Econception podcast. And also the piece is called How Trump's Tariff Table Was Made. That's for National Review. Dominic, really appreciate your insight on this. And thanks for coming back on the program.
Thanks for having me, Stu.
We've all been thinking about our investments a little bit more recently. Are you unknowingly bankrolling the destruction of your American values? You might be thinking about your returns right now, but are you thinking about what companies you're supporting? Do you know if your hard-earned dollars are being used to undermine the agenda that you believe in? Because now is not the time to be passive. Your investments should work as hard as you do and align with what you believe in. And that's why Constitution Wealth exists. They're not just financial advisors, they're patriots. They're building a parallel economy for people like you and me who've had enough. You know, have you joined the movement of Americans using their portfolios to hold companies accountable? It's time to stop funding the problem and start being part of the solution. And that's why Constitution Wealth exists. They're great people. You're going to love them. ConstitutionWealth.com/Blaze. You can get a free consultation right now. That's what ConstitutionWealth.com/Blaze. They do this every single day. They get you the returns that you want, and they navigate you around the issues companies you don't want to support. So check it out, ConstitutionWealth.com/Blaze. Constitution Wealth is a registered investment advisor. You should review Constitution Wealth's disclosures at ConstitutionWealth.com to understand their services and fees. All investing involves risk, of course, including the risk of loss. I am a client of the firm, and this is my paid endorsement. My opinions are, as always, are my own.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
So remember the Signal scandal. This was the thing where Mike Waltz was somehow added journalist Jeffrey Goldberg to the his chat on what was it, Signal, and they you know, discussed these intricate plans or at least timelines and such for an attack on the Houthis from back in the day. So. The question was, how did he get added to this? Obviously, it wasn't intentional to add a journalist to this private conversation. We now seem to have the actual answer to that, and it is bizarre, and it's something you need to know. If you have an iPhone, you should listen to this. According to the people briefed on the internal investigation, Goldberg had emailed the campaign about a story that criticized Trump for his attitude toward wounded service members. To push back against the story, the campaign enlisted the help of Waltz, their national security surrogate. Goldberg's email was forwarded to then-Trump spokesperson Brian Hughes, who has copied and pasted the content of the email, including the signature block with Goldberg's phone number into a text message that he sent to Waltz so that he could be briefed on the forthcoming story. Waltz did not ultimately call Goldberg, so Waltz seemingly is telling the truth here, the people said, but in an extraordinary twist, he inadvertently ended up saving Goldberg's number in his iPhone under the contact card for Hughes, now the spokesperson for the National Security Council. A day after that Goldberg story was published, Waltz appeared on CNN to defend Trump. Don't take it from me, blah, blah, blah. We remember that. According to the White House, the number was erroneously saved during a contact suggestion update by Waltz's iPhone. Now, I get these things all the time. You go in there and you say, oh, this would be like, oh, do you want to update this contact? It added to this number. What I thought that was someone like, if I'm, you know, I got Bob and I'm texting with Bob and it says, do you want to update Bob's number? My assumption was Bob added something to his contact and it was just picking that up and it was adding it. No, it seems like what's happening is the iPhone itself is detecting that number in an email or something and saying, hey, this is probably part of his contact. Do you want to add it? Well, I get those all the time. I always click yes because I just assume they want the update. You know, someone else, you know, like the person who I'm contacted with has changed their information. No, it's the iPhone. So what the iPhone apparently did was pick up Goldberg's email or number, I mean, in that previous email exchange. And because it wasn't a forward, it was a copy and paste job, the iPhone misread it and added his number under the other contacts. So there's no way he could have detected it. I mean, I even thought, like, this is a terrible mistake to make. Actually, I could totally see myself making that exact same mistake. So that is a kind of a shocking development there, and that's how this looks. So I would say, when it says, do you want to update the contact? Probably no is the answer to that next time. A couple other developments from the cabinet. MMR vaccine is the most effective way to prevent measles spread. This comes from RFK Jr., not necessarily controversial to be saying that. It's, you know, a lot of people say that sort of stuff. But to come from RFK Jr., who has been, you know, as skeptical on vaccines as you're ever going to find. I know this has created some consternation among his supporters, getting upset with him that he's being more friendly to vaccines now that he's in office. That's going to be an interesting one to watch. As I know, you know, a lot of people, I have some of my friends who work here, very skeptical on vaccines and were upset at RFK Jr. For that one. So we will find that one as well. And I mean, the one that really hits me the hardest is this hit piece trying to take out Bergamentum. People are trying to thwart and blunt Bergamania, and I will not stand for it. The Trump appointee is driving the White House nuts, according to The Atlantic. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum's office has asked its political appointees to learn how to bake chocolate chip cookies, to act as servers during a multi-course meal with guests, and to dispatch a U.S. Park police helicopter when he was running late to a flight with President Donald Trump. Look, I mean, I don't know. You don't want nice, freshly baked chocolate chip cookies at your meetings? I know I do. I would have them for the show every single day if someone would make them for me, but they don't make them for me. Can I demand that? Probably not. However, Doug Burgum is Doug Burgum. We're talking about Bergamentum here, okay? So if he wants chocolate chip cookies, let Doug Burgum cook. Well, not specifically. He doesn't want to cook the stuff himself, but let him cook in his job and other people bake for him his chocolate chip cookies, because you can't really do work in America without freshly baked, like break them in half, the chocolate chips pull apart because they're still melty inside. Without that type of chocolate chip cookie, how could any work get done in this country? Let me tell you about a new movie coming out this weekend. It's called King of Kings. It starts with a dad telling his son the greatest story ever told. But this is not just some boring Sunday school version. The kid actually steps into the story through his imagination. He walks with Jesus. He sees the miracles. He feels the betrayal. And he understands the sacrifice. It's powerful. It's emotional. And yeah, it's actually good. That's a thing that didn't used to happen with Christian films. Now it can happen. And this is not some like budget, you know, bargain budget voice cast. We're talking about people like Mark Hamill are in this, Ben Kingsley, Forrest Whitaker, Uma Thurman, Pierce Brosnan. I mean, this is like Hollywood royalty coming up for a Jesus movie, and I love it. I'm glad to hear that this can actually happen in our country. The animation is gorgeous, the story is moving, and it's a film the whole family can actually sit down and enjoy together this Easter. So pre-order your tickets now at angel.com/stew. Angel's done such a great job bringing, you know, Christian media and film back into the mainstream, making it actually solid and quality and good. They've done so much work on this, and this is no exception. It's angel.com/stew. The movie's called King of Kings. angel.com/stew. So go back about 125, 130 years, and I was a five-year-old, a kindergarten student, and playing my first year in Little League. And I was placed on a team called the Blue Jays. And that is the, by the way, we went 7-3 that year. 7-3. In fact, we were the only team that beat the Pirates, who finished 9-1. Just throwing that out there, just so history knows. But I became a Blue Jays fan because of that, which, you know, inexplicably, the only team that's not in the country I'm a fan of. And although I will say 51st state, you still call them America's team. So the Toronto Blue Jays, you know, and it's something that I've lived my entire life being a fan of the Blue Jays. And have brought up my son and my daughter to be Blue Jays fans as well. And, you know, they become, especially my son who loves baseball, is a huge Blue Jays fan. And we're big Vladimir Guerrero Jr. fans. It's our favorite player. We love Vladdy. And, you know, he has been in the Blue Jays organization for, gosh, you know, coming up like 10 years now, I guess. Gosh, it's been a long time. Coming up as like, he was drafted as like a 16-year-old. And he came up through the organization, has had, you know, MVP-type seasons, you know, top five MVP-type seasons. I think he finished second, was his best. And his contract was running out. I complained about it on the show earlier, like why they won't pay this one guy, the one guy who actually wants to play for this Canadian baseball team, give him the money that he wants. Well, he finally got the money he wants. Guerrero Jr. and Blue Jays agree on a $500 million deal. These numbers don't even seem real anymore. 14 years, $500 million. Technically, I guess, the third largest contract in history when it comes to baseball. And when it comes to current value, because the money was not deferred, it's the second largest, just Juan Soto's being larger. And, you know, while I'm, as a fan, really excited about that, it's also what I've been, like, crushing to see him leave. Like, you get attached to these guys, that are part of your favorite teams. And like to see him leave to go to some other team would just been so sucked. It's something I've shared with my son and my daughter, how much we love this guy. And now he's going to stay. It looks like maybe for life with the Toronto Blue Jays. So I'm excited about it. And again, like who knows what happens? This is going to take him to like his 40-year-old season. Who knows what this contract looks like when he's 40? But it's not my money. I don't care. I would have spent it anyway. Very excited. A positive development as we get back into baseball and something like take you a little bit out of the madness of the news. Baseball back. You can watch some baseball, enjoy the spring with your favorite players on the field. That's some good news for you. Here to start the week.